This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Right. The narcissistic cultism that we talked about last week is, among many other things, an excuse for narrowing one's interests, for being concerned about less and less and about fewer and fewer people. And we mentioned last week that this narcissistic cultism is unfortunately something which has penetrated even to within the walls of Yiddishkeit, and that today one of the most disturbing facets of modern Orthodox Judaism is the cultism, is the loyalty to cult before to Torah, the intolerance of other cults, the fighting and disputing with other cults, the lack of kavod, the lack of respect and honor between one cult and another. I want to examine this a little bit further, and I want to question whether it isn't perhaps possible that the whole system of narcissistic cultism in fact isn't a creation of the Torah. After all, we were the first cultists. A nation separate from all the other nations, not allowed to intermarry with the other nations. If they touch our wine, we don't drink it. If they make our cheese, we don't eat it. We don't let them cook for us. What better cult is there than that? And if that's not so, then why? What is the difference? In other words, what is cultism, and where is it allowed? And more particularly, there's clearly a tendency to be able to relate more easily to people who think the same way we do. There's clearly a tendency to underrate and to denigrate people who think differently to the way we do. How does one relate to people that think differently to the way we do? And I'm talking now not only about different shittas within Torah, but I'm talking even about right outside of Torah. How does one relate to non-Jews? How does one relate to idol worshippers? How does one relate certainly to Jews who practice a Yiddishkeit which may be foreign to our type of Yiddishkeit? And still more particularly, how do you love somebody that you hate? There are certain people one's meant to hate, and yet one's meant to love them also. So there are emotional demands on us which seem almost impossible to fulfill. How do you care about someone you don't care for? How do you care about somebody you hate? In a very short act in this week's Sedra, an act of three scenes, we have mapped out in front of us the growth of Moshe Rabbeinu. And it's introduced with these words, Vayahi Bayomim Hohem, and it was in those days, this is in Shemot chapter 2, verse 11. Vayigdal Moshe, and Moshe became great. We know that Vayigdal means he became great, and not just that he grew older, because in the previous pasuk it says Vayigdal Hayeled, the boy grew up. So we know already that he grew up physically. And in the very next pasuk we're told it was in those days Vayigdal Moshe, and Moshe grew. That means he grew in stature. And now we're going to see how he grew in stature. What were the things that brought about that growth in stature? Vayetze el echo, and he went out to his people. Vayar besiv loesom, and he saw their sufferings. This ability to relate to people who are outside of one's own framework of thinking, and this ability to love people for whom one doesn't particularly care, or to care for people who one doesn't particularly love, is something which is particularly important in the case of a leader. A manhig certainly has to know how to tolerate people that maybe don't toe his line. And here we'll see it all developing in one man. So he goes out to his brothers, Vayar besiv loesom. What does that mean, says Rashi? Nosan einov veliboy liheyos meitzar aleim. He devoted his eyes and his heart to feel sorry for them. The Medrash gives it in a little bit more detail, in fact, even than that. And the Medrash says, Vayetze el Echov, Vayar besiv loisom, and he saw their suffering. Mahu Vayar, what does it mean he saw? Shehoyoroye besiv lusam, because he saw their suffering, uvoyche, and he cried. Va'omer, and he used to say, Chaval li alechem, I have pity over you. Mi yiten muti alechem, if my death could get you out of your misery, I would give my life for it. She'en lecho melocho koshim imleches atzit, there's nothing so hard as the work that you're doing here with mortar and cement. Paya noisen kesefa v'mesayeya l'kol echod v'echod mehem, and he used to bend his shoulder and he used to help every one of them carry. He used to go around from man to man and help them. What could one Moshe do? There are thousands of Jews. How much could one Moshe help? But that wasn't the important thing. It's Vayar b'siv loisom. He shared their suffering together with them. He helped them in their work. He commiserated with them. He expressed sympathy with them, with each and every single one of them. This is quite an amazing thing, because Moshe was brought up in the court of Paro with every luxury he could possibly want. In fact, Mr. Cohen even wanted to say that he was a spoiled little boy, no? You did want to say that, didn't you? But he certainly had the opportunity of being a spoiled little boy. He was brought up in the midst of luxury, in the house of Pharaoh, as a prince. He was taken into the home, given authority and responsibility. And what does he do? He doesn't allow the palace to shield him from the suffering of his people. He doesn't allow the luxury in which he lives and the security in which he lives to present itself as a barrier between him and his people. And they're still his people. As we see, writes in the same pasuk, Vayar, and he saw Ish Mitzri Make Ish Ivri, and he saw an Egyptian hitting a Jew, Me'echov, one of his brothers. That's what hurt him. One of my brothers is being beaten by this miserable Egyptian. You know, sometimes, very occasionally, it happens that a Jew comes to a high position. And even in the White House, it can happen that a Jew attains a high position where he has, let's say, an influence on foreign affairs. What usually happens is he bends over so far backwards to convince everybody that he doesn't show any favoritism to the Jews that he becomes a worse anti-Semite than the Goy. One would think that there would be such a tendency with Moshe. Raised in the house of Pharaoh, in the palace, one would think he would like to feel himself as part of the Egyptian people and part of the Egyptian culture, and would certainly go out of his way not to feel part of the Jewish people. But no, despite the fact that he's been brought up there. Not just has he been brought up in Egypt in a free society the way we're brought up in this country, but he's brought up right in the midst of Egyptian culture as a VIP of Egyptian culture, someone really special and privileged among the Egyptian people. And yet when he goes out and he sees an Egyptian man oppressing a Jew, it's that miserable Egyptian oppressing my brother. That's what he feels. And that's a feeling that we don't even get that often. The feeling that a Jew is a brother, the feeling that when a Jew is being oppressed, it's my brother that's being oppressed, is something that even we don't have that often. But certainly Moshe, where does he get such a feeling from? He's been totally isolated from the suffering. He's been totally isolated from the Jewish people. Doesn't matter. It's Echov. This is one of my people. They're mine. He feels possessive about them. He feels close to them. And somebody else is persecuting him. And he looks around here and there. Vayar ki ein ish, and he sees there's no man. Vayachet ha-mitzri vayatmineyo b'cho. So he smites the Egyptian and he buries him in the sand. That's it, finished. Moshe, don't forget, is a Levi. Is this just the impetuousness of the Levim, as we discussed last week? No, not at all, because look what he does. Firstly, Rashi tells us who this Jewish man was. He was the husband of Shlomit Bat Divri. Shlomit Bat Divri is mentioned in Vayikra as being the only prostitute that was among the Jewish people. And Rashi explains there that she wasn't a prostitute in the normal sense of the word. She was a prostitute in that she used to talk a lot. And Chazal call a woman who talks a lot a prostitute, a zona. Because that's not part of the nature of the Jewish woman's role. She gets up into getting into all sorts of conversations, and she gets into all sorts of situations. A woman, like a man, should talk when there's something to say. But her name was Shlomis, Rashi tells us, because she used to go around saying hello to everybody. It's not right for a woman to go around saying hello to everybody. And she was Shlomis Bas Divri. She was the daughter of Divri, because Divri comes from the word Daber. He was also a speaker, so it was in the family. It was talking, always talking about people. And it doesn't bring any good to anybody. And this was her husband. And she was obviously said hello very nicely to this Egyptian. And the Egyptian gave her husband some work to do one night, put him on night duty. And he came and had an affair with Shlomit, who did not know that it was the Egyptian. And when Shlomit's husband came back and figured that something had gone wrong, the Egyptian realized that the husband had figured it out and felt it was time to kill the husband, which he did, which he was about to do. Vayifen kovacho, what does it mean? And he looked here and there. Ro'o ma'osaloi bevayisu ma'osaloi basode. Says Rashi, what does it mean? He looked here and there and he saw. It means he looked to see on what basis the Egyptian was hitting the Jew. He didn't just react impetuously. Sure, his initial feeling was one of indignation. My brother's being hit, but that's not a reason to hit the Egyptian. Let's find out what's the problem, what's happened. And he figured out the whole story about what the Egyptian had done and what the husband had done, and the whole story. And he realized that this is nothing that this man must be allowed to get away with. But still he doesn't kill him. There's one more check he still has to make. Vayarki einish, says Rashi. She'ein ish atid lotzes mimenu shiyiskaya. He was sure that no ish, no great man, was likely to be produced by this Egyptian who might one day convert or anything. That's the thought that went on in Moshe Rabbeinu's mind, despite the fact that he spontaneously wanted to kill the Egyptian. First he makes sure why he wants to kill it, and that al-pi halacha he's allowed to kill him. And then he makes sure maybe there's something that's still going to come of this man. Maybe it's worth leaving him alive. Who knows what will happen in the future? No, Moshe Rabbeinu checks right on, and he realizes that no good is ever going to come out of this man. Only then does he kill him. We see the beginnings of a leader here, the beginnings of a Yehuda, although he's not from the tribe of Yehuda. One already sees the qualities we discussed last week. He has the passions, but he also checks carefully. He understands the responsibility of what he's doing. It's all very well to kill this Egyptian, but maybe somebody great would come out of him later and you're responsible for him not coming out. Moshe checks that before he kills. That's the first scene. Moshe now must be in a situation of terrible danger. If it gets out that he killed the Egyptian, he's in trouble, and it's likely to get out. It's true that nobody was there, but he's going to be missed. His family are going to report him missing. They're going to find out he had an argument with a Jew. Moshe Rabbeinu was out. He was seen around. It's not going to take any amateur detective very long to find out that it was Moshe. So one would think he would keep away from the Jews for a few days, just sit in the palace quietly and keep his nose out of everybody's business. Not Moshe. Vayetze b'yom hasheni, on the next day he's out again. V'hinei shnei anoshim ivrim nitzi. Now we've seen Moshe Rabbeinu in a situation where he has seen an ish ivri me'echov being persecuted. A Jewish man, one of his brothers, and Chazal tell us, Orachai mentions it here on the spot, that when the Torah uses the word echov, a brother, it doesn't just mean a physical brother, but it means also echov b'mitzvah. He's somebody who keeps mitzvahs. When it says, for example, v'ahavta l'reyacha kamocha, you must love your friend as yourself, doesn't mean just every Jew, it means Jews who accept the Torah. There's no chiyuv in that terms of that mitzvah, just to love everybody. So here too, when it says that he saw the Egyptian smiting ish ivri me'echov, it was somebody he considered to be his brother. It was a tzaddik. And we see how Moshe responds when he sees a tzaddik being persecuted. He doesn't tolerate it. What would Moshe do now if he saw a Rosho being persecuted? Let's see this man, Moshe. How do you figure out? Okay, tzaddik being persecuted, he puts his life in danger. He puts his career in danger. He puts his future in danger. He puts his family in danger. No problem. He kills the Egyptian. Nobody's going to persecute this righteous man, the husband of Shlomis Bas Divri. But what about... what would Moshe do if he saw a wicked man being persecuted? So we see. On the next day, in Shnei Anoshim Ivrim Nitzim, two Jews are arguing. Vayomer LaRosho, and he says to the wicked one, Loma Sake Reyecho, why do you hit your friend? Say Chazal, why does he say your friend? Because they were both Roshoim. That's why he calls him your friend. So here he says two Roshoim, and in fact, you know who these Roshoim were?
nobody less than Dosan Vaviram, the miserable wretches. That's who it was. Dosan Vaviram, already now they start their problem. Now Moshe must have realized that Dosan Vaviram are going to cause the most incredible problems for the Jewish people. These are troublemakers. In every community one finds troublemakers, and usually one finds them two by two, like in the ark. One never finds them one at a time. One person can't make trouble. You need two people to make trouble, because you've got to have someone to talk to and to plot with and scheme with and make Lashon Hara. And in every community there's a Dosan Vaviram, there are two troublemakers who can destroy a whole community. Moshe must have seen that Dosan Vaviram were people who potentially could destroy the Am Yisrael. So he should have said to himself, let them fight it out. Even if only one of them gets killed in the process. You know, there's no Dosan without an Aviram, and there's no Aviram without a Dosan. There'll only be one of them. You need two troublemakers. But he doesn't. He interferes. Lama take Yisrael? Why are you hitting him? And Chazal said he didn't even hit him yet. He just raised his hand. But you're not even allowed to raise your hand against another Jew. That's not correct. One isn't permitted to do it. And if you do it, you're called a Rosh, or you're already called a wicked person just for lifting your hand even if you don't hit. And he goes to Dosan or Aviram, whoever it was, and says, why are you hitting your friend? So here we see, again, Moshe risking his life to save a Rosh who's being persecuted. It's becoming difficult to understand. What does it bother him? Let Dosan and Aviram fight it out. Why should he get involved? I can understand in the first scene, the person who's being persecuted is a tzaddik. You've got to save him. But in the second scene, the person who's being persecuted is a Rosh, and the person who's persecuting is a Rosh. Let them kill each other. Who cares? Moshe cares. And he saves them. And they in fact cause him to go into exile. Because they say to him, you're coming to kill us the same way as you killed the Egyptians. So it's already got out that he killed the Egyptians. So he flees. Vayira Moshe vayomar. Moshe was afraid and he said, already the matter is now known. And off he goes. So now we've seen Moshe in action in two tests. He's being tested as to how he feels, how he reacts when a tzaddik is being persecuted. And he comes out tops, he puts his life on the stake. Bnei Shalom isn't satisfied with that. If you want to be a manig, if you want to be a leader, we've got to see how you react when a Rosh is being persecuted. Puts his life on the stake. No problem. How would Moshe respond if he saw a goy being persecuted by another goy? Walks down the streets of Hillbrow and sees two Africans fighting with one another. Is he going to get involved or is he going to walk on? It's a big moral question. What do you do? Well, so the Rabbeinu Shalom decides to put him to that test as well. The next few psukim. He flies off to Midian. And we're told that the Kohen of Midian had seven daughters, and they came down to fill up their troughs with water to feed the flock of their father. And the male shepherds came and chased them away. Vayokum Moshe vayoshia. Not only are they not tzaddikim, but they're not even Jews. They're goyim. Not only are they goyim, but they're women. And you might think Moshe would say, a woman, you know. I'm not even allowed to look at a woman. How can I go and help them? No. He gets up and he saves them. He's gallant as well. And he chases these Royim away. Vayakum Moshe vayoshian vayashk es tzoinom. And he feeds their tzoin. That's it. You know, it's very often you'll find a religious person who thinks it's infradig to let a lady through the door first, or to pull up a chair for a lady. Let it do. Why should I? It's not right. Of course it's right. Depends what the situation is. You help anybody. And here you've got a situation of Moshe running to the help of a bunch of shiksas. That's what they were. A bunch of shiksas. But they're being persecuted. They're being hurt. They're being threatened. And Moshe doesn't stand around while anybody is being threatened. Moshe doesn't stand around while anybody's in danger. Even a bunch of shiksas. And some shiksas they turned out to be in the end. So we see that quite irrespective of the dinim of loving people, because that's quite a restricted din, one doesn't have to love everybody, there seem to be halachas about respecting people. There seem to be halachas about sympathizing with people, about having an emotional feeling of sympathy with anybody who's in trouble. We can take this further. There are a couple of examples. The one is in the case of that wicked rogue called Bilam. Bilam was the essence of what the Torah abhors. One of the most despicable people you can possibly imagine. That was Bilam. And you remember the story with Bilam and his donkey, and he gets onto his donkey to go and curse the people. Sorry. And the donkey stops in its tracks and doesn't move, and Bilam gets upset and starts hitting the donkey. And the donkey talks to him. And the donkey says, "What are you hitting me for? Have I ever done anything wrong to you?" And the donkey gives him a whole musa shmuz. Can you imagine being given? Oh, really, that's what it is. The donkey tells him how to be a mensch. What kind of human being are you? What kind of a man are you? And it goes on and on at him. And at the end he says, "What are you doing this for? Have you got any justification at all?" Vayomer, and Bilam says, "Look, you're right." You know what that is? To have to admit to a donkey that the donkey's musar is right? It's terrible. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam do afterwards? He kills the donkey. Immediately afterwards. Can you imagine what a Kiddush Hashem it would be if that donkey was still alive today? There's the donkey that spoke to Bilam. Imagine such a thing. But no, the Ribbono Shel Olam kills the donkey immediately. Says Rashi, why? Because the donkey spoke and gave you musar, and you couldn't answer that musar. You had to accept it as being right. As it says in the Torah, and Bilam himself said, "No, I've got nothing to say. I've killed the donkey." So that the people should not be able to say in the future, "This is the donkey that beat Bilam in Musa." And he wasn't able to answer him. That's why I killed her. Shechas. The word is just rubbed out here. Sorry, I just want to see what the word is. Shechas ha-mokom al kovod ha-brius. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam is sensitive about kovod habrius, about the honor of humanity, and that nobody should have be able to embarrass Bilam afterwards by pointing out the donkey that gave him musa. It's incredible. Bilam, that wicked so-and-so, who was out to destroy the Jewish people, who disobeyed the Ribbono Shel Olam, who was at the depths of immorality. The donkey speaks, and the greatest Kiddush Hashem could be achieved if that donkey would be preserved for people to see. The Ribbono Shel Olam kills the donkey immediately after he's spoken. Nobody else ever sees that donkey again. The only proof we have of it is the Torah. That's all. Nobody else saw it. Why did nobody else see it? Chas ha-mokom al kovod ha-brius. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam is sensitive about kovod ha-brius. Even a Bilam should never be put into the situation where he can be embarrassed because of the donkey. It's amazing. Here we're seeing obligations in kovod ha-brius that go far beyond the Jewish people, and in fact go far beyond non-Jewish righteous people, and even non-Jewish neutral people. We see obligations of kovod habrius now that go right into the realm of even non-Jewish wicked people. Still there's the din of kovod habrius. One has to relate to them with kovod, one has to relate to them with honor. Strange thing. One other case, which is also very interesting, this the Meiri points out in Brochas Daf Kaf Zayin. You remember the argument with Korach, another wicked man. This was a Jewish man, okay? Finally, the 250 men go into the Beis, into the Mishkan with their little pans to bring the sacrifice, and they're all wiped out, they're all killed. And when they're all dead, says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, "Emor el Elozar ben Aharon Akoin, say to Elozar, the son of Aharon, go and pick up the pans, clean up the mess." Why does he tell Eliezer, Elozar, to clean up the mess and not Aaron to clean up the mess? Says the Meiri, "Lelamed es habriyos derech eretz," to teach humanity derech eretz. It wouldn't be nice for Korach that the man with whom he had the argument is the one who cleans up the mess. That's not nice. Get somebody else to clean up the mess. You've won the argument. You've achieved what you've had to achieve. Still to gloat over your enemy after you've beaten him, that you're not allowed to do. To cause him bushor, to cause him embarrassment after you've beaten him, that you're not allowed to do. To beat him you were allowed to. To kill him you were allowed to. But not to embarrass him. There's no heter to embarrass him. Another example of this is in the case of Abraham. There are many examples in Bereishis, but perhaps one of the most outstanding ones is Avram, when the Ribbono Shel'olam tells Avram that he's going to destroy Sodom. What would we do? If the Ribbono Shel'olam came and told us that the Russians are going to invade Afghanistan, say, look, thanks for letting us know. Okay. Doesn't bother us. Are there any Jews in Afghanistan? We would ask. And maybe if we're particularly thoughtful and the Ribbono Shel'olam said, yes, there are a few, we would say, can't you get the Jews out before? Maybe we would say that. I don't even know if we would, but that's the most we would say. That's not what Avram says. And the Sodom, you can imagine, is not Afghanistan. I mean, Sodom is it's worse than Tehran or than Qum. I mean, Sodom is, it's unbelievable what Sodom was. It was the essence of corruption and rishus. Says Avram Avinu, maybe there are 50 tzaddikim. For 50 tzaddikim, won't you save the city? And 40 tzaddikim and 30 tzaddikim is not arguing for the tzaddikim, because in the end there was only one tzaddik and he got saved. So there was no question that the tzaddikim would get out alive. He wasn't arguing for the tzaddikim. He knew the tzaddikim would get out alive. He wanted to save the whole city. Why does Avraham Avinu want to save the city of Sodom? He should have been only too pleased. Again, so they must have caused him trouble. They must have caused him problems. They must have been a chilul Hashem altogether. They stood for everything which Avraham didn't stood. And they antagonized everything which Avraham stood for. Surely the best thing would be to see the end of Sodom. No, says Avraham Avinu. He stands and he pleads with the Ribbono Shel Olam on and on and on. Maybe because there are a few tzaddikim, you leave the whole city alone. Where does that come from? What's the basis for that? You know, we're lucky if we're not sameach ba'ed, if we don't in fact rejoice at the calamity of other people, even who are not our enemies, just our competitors. If our competitors have a misfortune and we don't feel good, that's already a high madrega. If our Rishoyim have a misfortune, if our enemies have a misfortune, not our competitors, our enemies, and we don't feel happy, that's really a high madrega. But to be in a situation where we would pray for their welfare, just imagine such a thing. It's unbelievable. It's almost unheard of. We need to clarify this a little bit, and more important, to understand how one achieves this. So here you've got a situation. Avraham is obligated to hate those people in Sodom. They're Rishoyim, they're wicked. People are obligated to hate Bilam. People are obligated to hate Korach and his whole crowd. Yet, simultaneously, we're obligated to give them cover. We're obligated to be careful never to hurt them. To be careful never to embarrass them. And to be careful to see that we never transgress the principles of kovod habrias, of honor and respect of that humanity. How do you do it? There's one further test that Moshe was put to. Believe it or not, after all this, where Moshe put his life on the stake when he saved the Jew, the tzaddik, from the Egyptian, he further put his life at stake when he saved the two Rishoyim, Dothan and Abiram. He further put his life at stake when he picked a fight with all the shepherds. He was one Jew with a couple of girls against a whole crowd of ruffians. Didn't bother him. He did it. Still the Ribbono Shel'olam isn't satisfied. If you want the job, Moshe Rabbeinu, you've got one more test to pass and then you're through. What's that? Says the Medrash, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Noisen Gedula LaAdam Ad Shebodkehu Bedova Kotam. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't give greatness to a man until he checks him with little things. Now you've been checked with big things, Moshe Rabbeinu. You killed an Egyptian. You intervened in an argument between Dos and Aviram. You saved some damsels in distress from a whole crowd of ruffians. All wonderful. Now we're going to test you on the little things. What are the little things? Moshe, like David HaMelech, was tested with a flock of sheep. Let's see how you handle lambs. Okay? We've seen you handle a Jew, a tzaddik, Wonderful. We saw you handle Arosha. Wonderful. We saw you handle some goyim. Beautiful. Let's see how you handle animals. What's that important? And the Medrash itself calls it a dover cotton. It says it's a small thing. If it's small, what difference does it make? If it's small, then it means it's not worthy of great attention. So if Moshe wouldn't have given it a great attention, surely it wouldn't be a point against him. So what then? You'll say it is worthy of big attention. Then it's not a dover cotton. Then it's not a small thing at all. Then it's a big thing. What happens? What's the story? Amru Rabbi Seinu, our rabbis tell us, Kishehoyo Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Hashalom Roye Tzoyna Shil Yisroi Bamidbar. On one occasion when Moshe Rabbeinu was looking after the flock of Yitro in the desert, Borach Mimenu Gedi, a goat ran off. What do you think he did? One goat. So one thing Moshe Rabbeinu could have done, if he was on a high madrega, what would Moshe Rabbeinu have done? Said, look, why did I choose to be a shepherd? Because it leaves me time to sit and learn. And that's the obvious thing. I can sit and all I have to do is keep an eye on the flock. So one goat is gone. What does a goat cost? I'll tell you. I'll tell Yitro to take the value of one goat off my wages. Surely my time is worth more to me. I'm going to go running after the goat. Who knows how long it will take me to catch the goat and to bring him back, and then to recover from being tired and thirsty and all that before I can get back to my learning. Who knows how long it will take? So let me tell Yitro to take off the value of one goat and let me sit down and carry on learning. I can't go learning looking after goats. But that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu does. He gets up and he chases after the goat. Moshe is a man somewhere between 40 and 80. We don't know exactly where this is, but it's just before the burning bush. So it's probably he's nearly 80 years old. The man in his 70s, looking after a flock of sheep, and one goat runs off. And he's busy learning, obviously. He closes his Gemara and he runs. Can you imagine the sight? Imagine seeing a chief rabbi running down the road after a goat. That's crazy. Who would do such a thing? It's not according to his honor. It's not what he should do. It's a waste of time. Doesn't matter. Not Moshe Rabbeinu. He runs after goats if you have to. Ad shehigia lahasuach. Until he got to a little bush. Kivan shehigia lechasuach, when he got to this little bush, nizdamna loy brecha shomayim, there happened to be a little pool of water, v'omad hagdi lishtos, and the goat started drinking. Kivan shehigia Moshe, it's not Moshe, panting, finally catches up with the goat and sees the goat drinking. What does he do? Scream at the goat, give him a hiding, don't you dare run away again, get back. Omar, he says, Anila Yisiyada Shirat Sayita Mipnet Soma. I didn't know you were running because you were thirsty. Imagine seeing the chief rabbi speaking. I don't mean our chief rabbi, any chief rabbi. Imagine seeing a chief rabbi speaking to a goat. And imagine you go there and there's, he says, I didn't know you were thirsty, never. What would we think of him? Think he's a Meshugana. Not Moshe Rabbeinu Olav HaSholem. There's Moshe Rabbeinu, a man in his 70s, the greatest man that ever lived up till then or ever after then, in terms of his powers of nevuah and leadership. And there he's standing talking to a goat. I didn't know that you were running because you were thirsty. Ayefata. You now must be not only thirsty, but you're obviously tired as well. He put him on his shoulders and he walked back. Never, you don't have to walk back. I'll carry you back. Imagine seeing a chief rabbi carrying a goat through the streets. It's just, it's not shayach at all, such a thing. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu said the Ribbono Shel Olam, Yesh lecho rachamim linog tzoyno shel basar v'dam. You have got the mercy to look after the flock of a human being. Kach chayecho ato tire tzoyni Yisrael. So you will certainly have the opportunity to be the shepherd of my flock, Am Yisrael. It's very strange. He's proved his mercy three times under the most severe circumstances, when his life is at stake. And he doesn't get the job after killing the Egyptian. He doesn't get the job after interfering in the machlokes with Dosan Va'aviram. He doesn't even get the job after he saves the daughters of Yisra. When does he get the job? After he saves a goat. What's going on? What's so important about the goat? And if it is that important, why does the Medrash say it's a dover cotton? It's a small thing. But I think here we have the essence of what Kovod HaBrios really is. What it means to have honor of humanity. Imagine You walk into a cockpit of a 747 when it's flying, and you're watching, all of a sudden a little red light starts flicking. And there's a note under that little red light: when this light flicks, you are in severe danger. The red light starts flicking. And everybody starts panicking. And they start checking and looking and rechecking and backwards and forwards and searching. What can be the matter? Imagine if you said to the captain, you know, I don't understand. There's so many lights here. There's so many switches here. There's so much. One little light's flicking and you get upset. What's he going to answer you? This one little light happens to be part of the whole system. You just see a whole lot of disconnected lights and switches, and one of them happens to be flicking, so you think, turn it off. But this light happens to be part of the system, and when this light's flicking, there's something wrong with the system. That's what kovod abriyah is. You've got to be checked with a dovar katan, checked with a little light flicking. If you respond when there's a little thing, why do you respond? Why does Moshe Rabbeinu respond to a thirsty goat? Stops his learning, stops watching the others, and runs after one little thirsty goat. Why does he do it? Because the goat's so important. The goat's not so important to justify his stopping to learn. That's not the critical thing. The critical thing that little goat is part of a huge, big scheme. That isn't just an isolated little goat. It's a goat that belongs to Yitro. It's a goat that the Ribbono Shel Olam created. It's part of the Bria. Yitro, his master, is part of the Bria. He owes an obligation to his employer. It's part of a whole system. The test is with little things, because when you're tested with something big and dramatic, you might be responding not because you respect humanity, but because you respect that particular person. Why did Moshe respond to the tzaddik who was being beaten by the Egyptian? Because he respected the tzaddik. Why did he respond to Dothan and Aviram? Maybe because there was something about them that appealed to him. He thought something might come of them. Why did he respond to the daughters of Yisro? Maybe he saw they were fine people, and maybe a wife would even come out of him from there. Who knows? But what we really want to check is, does Moshe have kovod habriyos? Does he respect the whole of humanity? Does he understand that there's a brio? And here I want to suggest, in fact, that the word brios, kovod habriyos, is normally translated correctly as honor of humanity. Whenever the Gemara uses the word brios, it means humanity. But strictly speaking, the word brios is the plural form of the word brio or berio. And that means a creature. And therefore I want to more accurately translate kovod habriyos not only as respect for humanity, but respect for living creatures, for anything alive. Okay? The respect has to be correctly placed. It mustn't be out of place. But respect for the Bria. Respect for that which the Ribbono Shel Olam created. And here one comes onto a whole new concept and a whole new understanding. Now it's irrelevant what you think of a particular individual. As far as kovod habriyos is concerned, imagine the captain of the plane says, look, don't worry about that little red light flicking. I hate that red light. It's always flicking. Forget about it. Leave it alone. What would you say? The man doesn't understand. The man is meshuga. So how can you say about another human being, forget it, he's a rosho. Leave him alone. What are you worried about him? He's part of the Bria. He's part of a system. The Ribbono Shel Olam inserted him and he has a part to play. How can you say forget about him? Don't care about him. If a pilot doesn't care about one little red light, he doesn't care about all his passengers. And if a human being doesn't care about one little human being, wherever he is, he can be in Afghanistan or in Iran or in Chile or in Alaska. If a human being doesn't care for that other human being at all, there's no caring whatever, then he doesn't care for the whole of humanity. That's clear. Kovod habriyos is in the little things. If a Godel B'Torah walks in, imagine that whoever it is, some big Talmid Chacham of Moshe Feinstein walks in through the door and we all stand up. That's not kovod habriyos. It's kovod for a Talmid Chacham. Imagine that the Queen walks in and we all stand up. That's not kovod habriyos. Kovod habriyos is the little things. When your African servant brings you a glass of water, do you say thank you? When the African servant, when you find and you come home and your African servant has cleaned your shoes, do you say that's her job? Or do you go and say, thank you for cleaning my shoes today? Or do you say, she won't understand that in any case. Thank you, she doesn't say thank you. Her culture doesn't know what saying thank you is, so why should I say thank you? What do you do? How do you relate to it? She's a Bria. She's part of the creation. She's part of the whole Bria. And I owe her kovod as part of the system, if nothing else. We're not talking about even the honor of her as an individual, or the honor of any individual. That's a different subject altogether, and we're not discussing that. What Moshe was being checked for here was kovod habriyos, with the dvorim ktanim, with the little things. Do you understand that servant girl is a Bria of the Ribbono Shel Olam? that God created her and put her there for a purpose, and that she's part of the whole scheme of things? You know, if you go to some of these old churches in Europe, beautiful things, works of art, every stone is a work of art, the way, the love with which these things were built, the artistry in their design and in their building, the painting, the stained glass windows. You see how they treat these things. You've got to be careful where you walk, you've got to be careful what you touch. The moment something starts flaking, they start fixing it up, constantly cleaning it. Have you seen how they treat the work of art in the Louvre? Don't see what how they treat the Mona Lisa. There's a whole fence around it, and lights on it, and you can't touch it, and you can't come near it. Such covered. Why? It's a Leonardo da Vinci. What do you mean? Have you seen how they look after a Michelangelo? Just you try and get anywhere near a Michelangelo. Try and drop a cigarette stub at the foot of a Michelangelo. Why? It's a Michelangelo. But you never hear people say, it's a Ribbono Shel Olam. This whole world is a Ribbono Shel Olam. Michelangelo makes one little pestle and we all, this is a Michelangelo. Leonardo da Vinci draws a woman and everybody stands off and careful how you touch it and always careful. And the moment there's a bit of flaking, it's in all the newspapers. Oi, 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 what's happening to the Mona Lisa? And she has to be restored and what will happen? But to deface the world, to throw your cigarette stubs on the floor, to leave tissue papers lying all over the place, to leave a mess behind you, that's okay, it's only a Ribbono Shel Olam, it's not a Michelangelo. That's what Kavod HaBrius is all about. To understand that a little goat is part of the Ribbono Shel Olam's creation. This is part of a work of art, of a work of science, of a work of such magnitude, that it's unbelievable. And if a person can't relate to those little things, he's not relating to the big thing. And sure, he'll stand up when the Queen walks in. And sure, he'll stand up when Reb Moshe Feinstein walks in. But to say thank you to his servant girl, that not. That means he doesn't know what Kavod HaBrius is. That means he has no love of the creation. Love of the Bria. And Gemara says that's why man was created single. So that everyone should say, Veshiyoma Kerechod Be'echod, Bishvili Nivra Ho'ilam, the whole world was just created for me. It's my business to be interested and to care for the whole world. Jews, non-Jews, tzaddikim, rishoyim, human beings, animals, the lot. It's all part of one massive system and I have to care. Sometimes my caring is out of hatred or is through hatred. A father sometimes hates what a child does. But he only hates it because he loves the child. If he felt indifferent about the child, he wouldn't hate. So there are two kinds of hating. You can hate as a defense for yourself. Makes you feel better when you hate a bit. That's not allowed. That you can hate out of love. Because I care for the Bria, I hate people who spoil it. But I care for those people who spoil it. I want to try and put it right. I'm worried about it. I'm concerned about it. That's what Kavod HaBrius is. And I found that this is the essence of a very beautiful piece which the Netziv writes in the introduction to Bereshis. He says the Sefer of Bereshis, according to the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, is called Sefer HaYoshor, the Book of Straightness, because it talks about Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov, and they were straight people. And he goes into a very brief analysis of what straightness is. He says, V'ha'inyan denitba'er b'shirat ha'azinu. It says in praise of God in Hazinu at the end of the Torah, Tzadik v'yosharhu. He's a tzadik and he is yoshar, he's straight. That implies that these are two different midas. You can be a tzadik and not be straight. You can be a tzadik and straight. And we praise the Ribbono Shel Olam in that not only is he a tzadik, not only is he righteous, but he's straight as well. Dishvach yosharhu ne'emar. Says the Netziv that he explains there that the praise of straightness is to explain and justify God's action in the destruction of the second temple where the generation was crooked. What was crooked about them? Ufirashnu, when we explain shayu tzadikim v'chasidim v'amolei Torah, the people of the generation of the destruction of the second temple, listen to these words, were tzaddikim, they were righteous, v'chassidim, chassidim is an even a higher degree of righteousness than tzaddikim, Va'amole Torah, they used to sweat and toil over their Torah. They learnt, they didn't waste a minute.
So why was the second temple destroyed?
Achloy hayu yeshorim bahalichos olamim. They weren't straight in their ways of the world. Their Torah they learnt, their bein adam lechaveiro was okay among themselves, their mitzvahs were kept meticulously, but bahalichos olamim, in their normal day-to-day activities and relationship with the world, they weren't straight.
Akein mipnei sinas chinam shebelibam ze choshtu es mi sheroo shenoeg sheloi kedatom beyiras Hashem.
And as a result of that, or it expressed itself in the following way, they suspected anybody who didn't belong to their cult, anybody who didn't serve the Ribbono Shel Olam the same way they did, they considered apikursim. They considered, what's the translation of apikuris? Heretics, non-believers, whatever you want to call it. Off the rails. Anybody who doesn't hold like I hold is an apikuris. This is the time of the destruction of the second base on Ebush. That's what the Ribbono, and they came to types of murder as a result of this. And to all sorts of other bad things that Shechorov Abayis until the temple was destroyed. And on this there was the Ribbono Shalom took punishment. Why? Because God is straight. The Einoi Sovel Tzadikim Kail, and he can't stand Tzadikim like that. Tzadikim, Chasidim, Amolei B'Toyro, great, wonderful people. The Ribbono Shel Olam can't stand them because they look at anybody who isn't identical to them as if they're off the rails.
Ela ba'ofen sheholchim b'derech hayosho, gam ba'alichus oylam v'loy ba'akmimus.
But they must go the straight way and not crooked. Apagav shu l'shem shemaim, even though they do it for God's name, they don't just do it for their own good. When they call somebody an apikoris, they justify it. We've got to make it known. People must know that this man is dangerous.
Dezeh gorim churban habriya. Why? Because that causes a destruction of the bria, of the creation. Their Torah is okay. Their learning is wonderful. Their mitzvahs are good. But they're going to destroy the world.
This is an incredible chiddush, that you can have a tzaddik and a chosid. You can have a great righteous man who can destroy the world with akmimus, with crookedness in his dealing with people.
Vezeh yoshvach ha'ovus. And this was the praise of the fathers. Shel milvad shehoyu tzaddikim v'chassidim v'ohavei Hashem ba'ofen ha'yoser efsha.
Because quite apart from the fact that they were tzaddikim and chassidim and lovers of God as far as it is possible to be, Oid hoyu yeshorim, in addition to that, they were straight. Hainu, that means, she's nagu im umas ha'olam, that they related even to the goyim. Afilu ovdei ililim chuorim, even those ugly idol worshippers. Mikol makom, nevertheless, hoyu imam ba'ahavo, they loved them. V'choshu letoivosom, and they cared for their goodness. Ba'asher hi kiyum habriya. Not because they were concerned about them as individuals. They were Rishoyim, they were wicked, they were idol worshippers. But they're part of the system. They're part of the Bria. And you can't just say because they're idol worshippers they don't belong here. But Ribbono Shel Olam created them and he put them there. And anything that God created, I care for. Now Michelangelo can make a piece of work that is bad. And it's still valuable. Michelangelo can make a piece of work which people ruin, which people spoil. And it's still a Michelangelo, it's still looked after very carefully. But Ribbono Shel Olam can make people who ruin themselves and they become idol worshippers and they become Rishoyim, but they're still creations of the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're still part of the Bria, they're part of this magnificent system which is the world. And if you have respect for the system, if you have respect for the Bria, you've got to have respect for them as part of the system, if nothing else. That's Yashnus. That's what straightness is. Can you imagine what a world we would live in if this was followed? We're not even talking about covered. We're not even talking about honoring it. We're not even talking about tzedakah. We're not even talking about chesed, about kindness. We're not talking about any high levels. We're talking about the very, very bottom level of human decency. Without this, there's nothing. Without this level, there's no chesed, and there's no tzedakah, there's no nothing, because you don't care. That's what it really is. You know, you'll usually find that in a community that denigrates other communities, or a group of people that denigrates other groups of people, or families that denigrate other families, you'll usually find that there's sin or there's hatred among themselves, that they talk about themselves that way as well. Because if you've got no covered habrius, if you've got no respect for the bria, for the whole creation, how are you going to have respect for individuals? Where's it going to come from? On what basis? The whole world, which includes everybody that's in it, and more than that, you're not going to have respect for, but you're going to respect individuals. Where from? How? The very first step and the very first element is covered habrius. A man drives in his car and throws a cigarette stub out of the window. There's no covered habrius. A man leaves the pavement in front of his house in a mess so that it makes the whole area look ugly. There's no covered habrius. A man walks around with dirty clothing. There's no covered habrius. Covered habrius is to understand that you're in the midst. Not only are you looking at, but you're actually surrounded by the most beautiful and incredibly great creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And one behaves accordingly. Imagine what would happen if one dropped dirt on a work of art. Imagine what people would do. Imagine what they would think. Who would even do such a thing? A real coarse nobody wouldn't do it. There's just that atmosphere of importance. This is something important, and it's something special, and that's not how you handle it. But to drop dirt on each other is all right. So talk. Imagine how people don't even talk that way. Imagine talking in a derogatory way about Michelangelo. You don't do it. After all, even about one of his works. So you personally don't like it, but you don't talk in a derogatory way, because it's accepted by everybody as being great art. So you make an idiot of yourself if you talk badly about it. But to talk badly about the Ribbono Shel Olam's creation, that's somehow we're qualified to do. There's just no basis for morality without this. If there's no yashrus, that's which the Netziv calls yoshur, straight, and which we're calling kovod habrius, just simple recognition of brius. If there's none of that, there's none of anything. And the test is in the little things. The test is not in the big dramatic things. The test is how you relate to the goat. The test is how you keep your place clean. The test is whether you clean up behind you. The test is whether you say hello and goodbye when you're talking to people. Do you say please and thank you when you're talking to people? When you didn't hear somebody, do you say I beg your pardon, or do you say what? It's not terribly important, and yet it's so important. If you didn't hear, somebody is talking to you and you didn't hear, that means you weren't concentrating sufficiently carefully. And you're asking him to go to the trouble of repeating something he's already said. The correct word is, I beg your pardon, I'm terribly sorry. Please excuse me, would you mind repeating yourself? Not what? What did you say? It's kovod habrius. Even if you don't think anything of the man you're talking to. If a person comes into your house who's really a nobody, who's really a nothing, doesn't matter, he's part of the bria. And you treat him as such, even if you don't like him, with certain common respect in the small things, you have to treat him that way. One can't allow one's personal feelings for that individual to come into the way of one's feelings for the whole bria, for everything altogether. And in fact, there's just one last medrash, and with this we'll really finish, which is quite an amazing one too. When the three visitors came to Avraham, and he was suffering, he had just had his operation, he had just had his bris milah, and it was as hot as anything. The three visitors on the horizon. Omer Rabbi Levi, echad nidmelo bidmus sarki, vechad bidmus navti, vechad bidmus arovi. They would look like three goyim, a sarki, a navti, and an Arab, whatever they were. They were three of the local kinds of tribes. So let's compare it today like three Africans. Okay, a Zulu and a Tswana and a Khoza. You're sitting in the, and you've just had an operation. 3 days, you're an old man. It's as hot as anything. You've gone onto your balcony to get a little bit of fresh air. And up the road, you see three Africans. A Khoza, a Tswana, and a Sotho, or a Zulu. And they look tired to you. Would you even bother to take a second look? Avraham does. It's brios. They're human beings. But he says the following. Let me look carefully. If I see that the presence of God is with them, I know they're great. They're Arabs, they look like ordinary Arabs, but they might be great Arabs. The Imani Roya Oisan Cholkim Kovod Elul Elu. But if I see them showing respect to one another, ani yodea shehem bnei adam mehugonim, then I know that they're fine people as well. So you can have a great person who's not a fine person. Says Avraham Avinu, my Rosh Hashiva and Mir used to say that from here, he used to learn that if he saw that they were not mehugonim, if he saw that they weren't respecting one another, he wouldn't have invited them into his house. Even though the Shekhinah was on their heads, even though God was in their presence, even though they were great people. What is the essence of whether you get an invitation into Avraham's house or not? Whether you're hogun, whether you're a mensch. And what's a mensch? Chelek kovod zeh lazeh. How do you relate to one another? The little things he watches. What can he see from a distance? He watches three Arabs walking together. But just by the way they speak to each other. He can tell by their movements. He can't even hear. He's too far. All he can do is watch. Watch their body language. To see whether they're relating to one another with kovod. That's what defines the very first level of menschlichkeit. And that's all Avraham wants. They can be the biggest gedolim, but if there's no menschlichkeit, he doesn't want them in their house. They can be simple Africans or simple Arabs, but if they're mehugonim, if they're fine people who know how to relate to one another, they're welcome into my house. And what does he see? He sees that they relate finely to one another. And off he runs. Avraham Avinu, the old man, running to these three Arabs, bowing down to them, pleading with them to come and have something in his house. They're not tzaddikim, as far as he knows. They're not Jews, Arabs. But they're mehugonim. They're fine people. They have that first level of menschlichkeit. And I think that's what it really means when we say, Ein derech eretz, ein Torah, derech eretz kodma la Torah. That derech eretz comes before Torah. And we've often talked about the fact, how can derech eretz come before Torah? Surely you can learn derech eretz from Torah. This level of derech eretz you've either got or you haven't got. Kovod habrius, you don't learn that from Torah. You learn that outside. When you look at a flower, when you look at a bird, when you look at a human being, when you read a bit of science, when you see the brilliance of humanity, when you see the brilliance of the creation, that's where you develop kovod habrius. If outside you haven't developed kovod habrius, you haven't developed an awe of the creation, a love of the creation, a desire to bow down before the creation as a sign of respect to the Creator. If that hasn't been developed outside, what are you coming to learn Torah for? Whose Torah is it? It's the Torah of He who created that outside, and you don't think very much of what's outside, do you? So what you're coming to learn is Torah for. It's like saying, I don't think very much of Michelangelo, let me go and spend 10 years studying Michelangelo. What for? The first thing before you'll study it is that you'll be inspired by it. You'll be struck with awe, you'll be struck with a sense of kovod. And so it is, derech eretz kodma la Torah, before you come to Torah, you must have derech eretz. Derech eretz means kovod habrius. That you're able to show that first level of respect for all humanity. Jewish, non-Jewish. Tzaddik, Rosha. From Sodom, Korach, Bilam. Makes no difference. The daughters of Yitro, Dothan va'Aviron, the husband of Shlomis Bas Divri. Makes no difference who. They're part of the Bria. They're part of that wonderful creation which the Ribbono Shel Olam made. And that's what I want to show kovod to. When there's that feeling, when there's that understanding, then to learn Torah makes sense.